Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Carrie murdered a child.
The evidence and the counter-evidence, I'm struggling with that.
When the facts are filled with coincidences, don't dismiss those coincidences.
I have no tolerance for the unexplainable.
Well then, sir, you'll have no tolerance for me.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching The Outsider. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us for the first time on Still Watching, what we do every week is we pick a show that Richard and I are both watching and slightly obsessing over. We break down the latest episode. There will be no spoilers about the future of the season, mostly because we don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, there's a book, but we don't know what's going to happen on the show. So there will be no book spoilers, no look aheads at the future episodes. Today we are talking about season one, episode 7, In the Pines, In the Pines.
I do have one spoiler, but it's probably kind of obvious just as you look at the Easter eggs. But I think this season's going to end in 3 episodes.
Oh, whoa. Whoa, yeah. You just blew my mind with that theory, Richard.
Isn't that crazy?
This episode was directed by Dana Reed and written by Richard's Massachusetts cousin, Dennis Lehane.
Oh, yeah.
We will get into the Lehane of it all later on. I'm just kidding. Richard's not actually related to Dennis Lehane, as far as I know. But
I mean, probably.
Everyone from Massachusetts is related to Richard, as far as I'm concerned. So we're going to talk about all of that. The Lehane angle is really interesting to me. So let us dive into that. But first, we're going to get to some emails from you guys. You can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And we love to hear from you guys. We've had like a very active email conversation this season with you guys, and that makes us really exciting. By the way, we don't have screeners for future episodes of this show at this point, so we're going to be recording these episodes on Monday, so you're going to be getting them a little later instead of dropping them Sunday night. We're going to be watching with the rest of you guys and then recording on Mondays. But what that means is that if you have thoughts about the current episode you just watched and want to hop on your email Sunday night and dash us, I mean, what else would you want to do but email us on a Sunday night? We can read sort of your reactions to the current episode rather than the previous week's episode on the podcast, and we would love to do that. So, but we are not quite there yet, so we are still in episode 6 territory with these emails, starting with this one from Rosalind, which I really liked because it's some bus driver intel. You may recall, in a previous episode, when Holly has this like vision of the bus crashing and she freaks out, and the bus driver sort of turns around and almost causes an accident in his reaction to her freak out. And so Rosalind writes in and says, my mom's partner is in safety management with the bus/train system in Pittsburgh, PA. He was so mad about the bus crash scene. We had to pause the show and talk about it. Okay, this is Joanna. I love when experts watch TV shows and get really mad about how their profession is being depicted. Anyway, he was so mad about the bus crash scene, we had to pause the show and talk about it. He said that bus drivers are trained to never turn around while driving. If someone was making a scene like Holly was, the driver would look through the rearview mirror to assess the situation. And that's just like, that's it. That's all Rosalind had to say. This gentleman had to say about bus driving. But like, that's interesting to me. I'm not saying you should test this theory by causing a scene on a bus, but that's interesting for me to know that bus drivers just have to keep their eye on the road. And I suppose like just pull over when it feels safe to deal with the incident going on behind you. But
yeah.
That was kind of interesting.
I'll bear that in mind when I'm on the Bolt bus or something next and just take a little comfort in that fact.
You could cause as much of a scene you want, so no one's going to turn around. All right. And then this one comes from Liz. And Liz says that she's a big King fan and a fan of Still Watching, so she's really excited that we were doing this show. She says, I was worried when I first saw the trailers. I've read the book and King adaptations are tricky, but it's become a wonderful, surprising delight. I wanted to mention the use of the song Jet Black by Channel Trace in the scene where we see next stretch victim in the strip club lost in thought before he hauls off and punches one of the guys, causing a ruckus in the club. So this is Claude she's talking about. And her theory here is that he's triggered by the guy who cuts him, the second person to cut him. Did it trigger the memory of being scratched? And I think I like missed that he got cut, and that makes sense. Because I think we were like kind of curious why Claude sort of reacted the way that he did in that scene. And we get a little bit more of that fallout in this week's episode 7, when he like quits and leaves because he just is not feeling himself. Right. But the lyrics of the song that are playing, this song Jet Black, as this is happening, so she says, coming off the painful debacle of Holly's reveal meeting and the resulting fallout, which has everyone wrestling with the info delivered, that the real murderer is a supernatural being who's been around since who knows when, creating pain and feeding off of it, hiding the shadows both literally and figuratively, and getting away with what he does, unknowns, unsuspected, until now. Here are the lyrics that we hear clearly as the strip club scene begins. I never reply when you hit me. I'm off the grid, you can't get me. And she's like, I just love that. The rapper's bragging the way El Cuco would if supernatural beings existed and bragged about their crimes, and if they decide to lay their brag down on a track to sick beats. She says, I also want to mention that the camera pan on the devastation that is Jack's apartment post beating at the hands of his mother / El Cuco was horrifying, truly horrifying. It seemed to go on and on, and the first thought I had upon watching it was something awful and unspeakably violent occurred in this space. I mean, yeah, we just seen most of the action, but the aftermath was devastation and violence in a stunning visual. For me, it was more upsetting than the beating itself. I don't know if this was purposeful, but I wonder if there was a subtle nod to domestic violence and or violent crimes against women in that visual. There was something glamorous or sensational about the aftermath, something a female director would understand well, and add to the fact that Jack was applying makeup later to cover the wounds. Thank you for reading. Big fan, Liz in Madison. So I guess I hadn't thought of that. We had talked about sort of Jack and this metaphor of alcoholism in that aftermath, but I hadn't thought of it in terms of domestic violence. But I think seeing the scene again this week in episode 7 through Alex and Ralph's eyes, I like that interpretation from Liz. I think it's an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like it's kind of classic Stephen King to make real world horrors that much more kind of stark with a kind of touch of supernatural stuff, it's kind of highlighting stuff that actually happens in the real world that's bad, through the lens of, you know, something kind of fantastical.
Yeah. I think that, so HBO has, you know, sometimes HBO does this thing where they're like inside the episode, which I sometimes don't watch because I'm watching a screener. But since I watched this episode on HBO, I stuck around and watched the thing. And they did a video package that was supposed to go, like it was supposed to cover episodes 5, 6, and 7. So they're not doing it for every episode, but they did one this week that sort of covered the last 3 episodes. And they have, an interview with Stephen King in there, which I thought was interesting. And he, because King doesn't always undersign his adaptation. So it's clear that, you know, he's, you know, at least invested enough in this one to give them an interview about his work. But he said in this interview, he said, fear, we all have a fear of death. I'm sorry, I wrote this down so it's a paraphrase, but he said, we all have a fear of death, a fear of pain, and we tend to gravitate towards stories where those things take a concrete form that we can grasp. El Cuckoo is that kind of creature. And so that idea, I mean, that's like, you know, that's King in a nutshell, right? But that idea of an embodiment of pain or an embodiment of death, and like, it made me want to try to really think about like what all the characters in this story that we're watching could gain by having a concrete manifestation of death or pain that they could grasp, and what would they do with it, you know? You know, like what will it do for Ralph to be able to, you know, hold and you know, kill pain or kill death, you know, and the way that that extends to the grief that he's going through with his own son and stuff like that. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
No, I mean, I think that was pretty succinct.
Okay. I mean, I have some questions around Holly and mm-hmm. her relationship to pain. As many of our listeners who have read the book have written in, Holly's in a different point in her life in the books. She's just like lost someone really close to her in the books. And Holly has lost, I think she's lost her mother, is something that she talked about briefly in an earlier episode, but it's not something that, like, whatever she's grieving is not something that we see as a consistent theme in her character, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
She doesn't strike us as a grieving character. So, all right. So those are some great emails. We got a ton more, but please keep emailing in. I read all of them, even if we don't read them on air. So thank you so much for sending them. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Let us get into this episode. We start with the morning routines of both Ralph and Andy. And I don't know about you, but I really love Andy's little home. He's got like a beautiful little window over his bed, yeah. A lot of natural light. Just saying,
he's doing pretty well.
Andy continues to be a catch. It's very tidy. He's very clean. Yeah. The Andy of it all, let's just quickly address the Andy of it all. You know, I'm a big Andy fan, but I am curious what role he serves in this episode. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's kind of about further building this kind of coalition of people that we're seeing form in order to combat this, just as like the kids in It or the grown-up versions of the kids in It 2, or, I mean, they're all the characters in the same book, but in the movies, kind of band together to fight the big bad. So I think he's a welcome addition to that. I think also that moment when he shows up and Holly kind of pulls a little trick on him and is like, what are you doing here? And then she like gives this big smile and a hug. And like, we haven't really seen that from her yet. So I feel like he's a good, way for her to sort of, you know, express more of herself. Although I have to say his reemergence and now sort of getting back closer to the case, as it were, I'm a little worried about him again.
I know. I'm like, Andy, stay away. You were safe, far away from the monster. Yeah. I am like both thrilled and very worried that Andy is here. But yeah, that opening up of Holly, you know, I like the, you know, performance Cynthia Erivo has been giving with Holly as like extremely reserved, but like her emotions are still accessible, I think, to us as viewers. I think that's worked really well. But this episode, yeah, does a lot to open her up in three ways. And like, I think, you know, the experience that she went through with Jack is sort of an understandable reason why she's sort of cracked open in a way we haven't seen. But she's got that scene, right, where she like smiles and hugs Andy and it's very sweet. She's got the scene where she and Jeannie are yelling at Ralph about like the way in which he's sort of obstructing the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ending, which is her screaming because she's had this dream or vision of having her head blown off. So, yeah, I feel like I really understand the first two, and then I'm having trouble with the third part, the screaming at the end. What was your interpretation of the way in which the episode closed out?
I almost kind of thought that, like, that it was trying to say that even if you are not, you know, touched by the demon, that it still gets in your head, you know, and that, like, even an imagined, I mean, she already did endure a trauma. I mean, it's really scary. Everything that happened to her was really, really scary. But, like, I don't know, the fact that, like, you know, this thing, this entity keeps, you know, not just targeting one thing, but enjoying the sort of, you know, concentric circles, the ripple effects of the one thing. And here is a ripple effect, you know, someone who has maintained a pretty, you know, calm composure and sort of a pragmatism is now, you know, having night terrors just like everybody else. And even maybe we're more palpably, because of this thing, you know? So I think it's just kind of showing it has a physical power, but it also has this kind of more ineffable, emotional power that, you know, can affect even the most sort of gathered of people.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. Yeah, watching her lose her composure completely and just scream in the, like, is that a reaction I would have to a nightmare where I got shot in the head after having a really traumatic, like, kidnapping experience? Probably. But is it ever the reaction that I would expect Holly to have? No. And so it's extra unnerving. You know, like, if Glory were to scream in any scene, you're like, yes, Glory seems like 5 seconds away from screaming at any point in this show, you know, understandably so. But, like, Holly, to watch Holly lose her composure like that, it was really disturbing. I thought it was a really powerful way to close the episode.
And it makes me think of the scene with Tamika where, you know, Ralph goes to be like, what was up with Jack? Like, you know, whatever. And she says, you know, maybe when I come back, I'm going to go to computer crimes. And she was like, I'm tired of the horror show or something like that. She said something about the horror show. And you think about Holly, who probably is used to investigating, you know, not stuff like this, certainly, that, like, that kind of, that deep dive into this world of misery and pain is, like, going to have an effect at some point, you know, and this was her kind of viscerally processing that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really, really strong, upsetting stuff. And what's interesting to me about this episode is that, you know, you and I had our theories about what we were going to see. Like, okay, so Jack has Holly. He's going to take her to the barn. There's going to be, like, a physical struggle and maybe she'll, like, get away and then people will finally, like, believe, you know, what's going on. And I really like that we were pretty wrong about that in terms of the fact that, like, the tension of the episode is not, will Jack, a completely evil entity, hurt Holly, our hero that we care about? It's the struggle within Jack himself, who has become an extremely compelling character to me, at least. This, the way in which he's fighting against this force that has chosen him and is pushing him to do things that are against his internal moral code, and the struggles he has with that. I mean, I'm not like, you know, I don't want to, like, sympathize with the kidnapper fully or whatever, but that's, you know, Holly, Cynthia Erivo said in the post episode interview that, like, Holly's main objective, or not her main objective, is her own safety, but she's also, like, really trying to save Jack at the same time, like, genuinely, not just, like, trying to cozy up to him to, like, you know, protect herself, but genuinely trying to reach him. And
right.
I think that's so much stronger than something that's much more clear cut. Like, how did the Jack stuff land with you?
I mean, credit to the performance, because it's truly, you know, I guess probably, you know, male actors are less inclined to feel this way just because of the shittiness of the industry. But, like, you know, when it's just truly an ugly role, and it's a really painful performance, like, in a good way. And, like, the way that he commits to it, it's just like, I, you know, he's revolting. Like, I have a hard time watching him with all the makeup on and the bulbous kind of puffed up face and not just this kind of, you know, rictus of agony all the time. Like, it's brutal, but I think he's really good at it. But yeah, I agree that, like, you know, I keep mentioning this, I feel like, every episode, but, like, the show is so carefully balanced to not have it be outright miserableism at all times. And I think a way that it does that is it keeps these characters very human. And even Holly, who's sort of, you know, a collection of sort of literary tics and whatnot, but, like, I feel like they've found ways to sort of, you know, you know, humanize her and everybody involved, and then also humanize the stakes of what we're dealing with. You know, we see things like Ralph and Jeannie, like, talking about, like, ordering dinner instead of cooking. We see all these quotidian things with Glory and her kids and pancakes and whatnot, you know. And then we see this thing where, you know, Holly recognizes the danger, but also sees the humanity and realizes that those, you know, the afflicted people who are kind of doing the bidding of the demon are part of the tragedy. Right. And if you can save them too, like, that's further victory against this thing that they're trying to figure out how to fight.
Right. And we find out later on that Jack was trying to take Holly actually away from the barn. Whether or not he's trying to take her wherever he winds up going, like, my suspicion is that Jack is following Claude to wherever Claude is going. Like, that seems like correct. I don't know if there's, you know, roadside evidence to the contrary, but it seems like, you know, if Claude has left town and is moving elsewhere, that El Cuco would send Jack after Claude. So, like, that was my thought.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, he's not taking Holly towards the barn, and there's a possibility that the reason he was going in the opposite direction of the barn is that he didn't want to, like, hurt her in some way. And what he really wanted from her more than anything was answers as to why this was happening to him, how can I understand what this creature is, and, like, is there any way for me to free myself of it, you know, other than death? Is there some answer for me other than death here? You know, so. And I thought it was really powerful, the fact that that's what he took from the information that he hears about what happened to Tracy before him. And we see him try to kill himself and he can't, and he's frustrated, which was our theory about Tracy as to why Tracy, like, put himself in front of the line of bullets.
Right.
Because he couldn't kill himself. So, but yeah, those, I know that all sounded very dark, but you're right that this episode has a bunch of, like, interesting touches of humor, like, the therapist saying, like, if I was interested in voodoo, I would have gone to voodoo school or whatever, uh-huh. Voodoo med school. And that is very Dennis Lehane, right? Dennis Lehane does, like, pitch black subject matter with these odd sparks of humor, that sometimes at their best, create something that is, you know, palatable despite how pitch black the subject matter is. And I think you see that really well calibrated in this episode. For our listeners who don't know who Dennis Lehane is, he wrote Gone Baby Gone, Mystic River, Shutter Island, and some episodes of The Wire and Boardwalk Empire. So, you know, that's our guy. What do you have any, I don't know if you, like, as a someone from Massachusetts, Richard, do you have any, like, specific Lehane thoughts or, like, you know, the themes that he likes to explore in his work?
Yeah, I think it's funny, kind of like Richard Price is maybe for New York, or I guess to some extent Baltimore too, but mostly New York. Like, Dennis Lehane, at least growing up in Boston, like, he was our sort of, like, you know, one of our tough guy poets, you know, he understood the sort of mean streets, but had an air of the sort of literary about him. And, you know, you look at, like, a movie adaptation of Mystic River, the Clint Eastwood film, which won a bunch of Oscars and, or at least was nominated for a bunch and won Sean Penn an Oscar. Like, there's, you know, there's that kind of duality of the tough stuff, but also this kind of, I mean, maybe it's a Catholic kind of grace, but there is a sort of, you know, sense of transcendence, I guess you could say. So it's interesting to watch Lehane come on to a Richard Price show, because I do think that while Richard Price also has, you know, that sort of, like, his ear to the streets and kind of, you know, can speak the patois of police and whatever, I think Lehane has a more sort of emotional touch than Richard Price typically does. And so it's interesting watching that come to bear here on this kind of very pivotal episode where, you know, I thought this turning point was going to come maybe an episode earlier in the season where, like, pretty much everyone is now getting on board with things and we're really kind of narrowing down into this pursuit, you know, because we even, you know, so anyway, I just think that, like, it's interesting that they brought him in for that particular episode, which I think, again, while, you know, putting the narrative pieces in place so we can get to our climax and whatever, also just kind of further textures out the emotional stuff. I think, you know, not just with Holly or Jack, but also with Glory and her sort of failed return to work that was maybe partly of her own doing, you know, and then the kind of thing with the realtor who her coworker who's like, you know what, actually, you're right. Don't let them run you out of town. Like these, I like that we're sort of considering now the future.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting to me because Richard Price wrote the first five episodes of the season, and then a writer, Jesse Nixon Lopez, wrote last week's episode, episode six. And then it's Dennis Lehane, Richard Price, Dennis Lehane, Richard Price. So Dennis Lehane is coming in as a closer sort of for like two of the last four episodes. And I think he's an incredible choice because like something that he likes to do, as far as I've observed from reading his stuff, is just those really thick moral quandaries where it forces you as a reader to grapple with, it makes you as a reader confront what you think is right and then how rigid is that belief. So let me explain. For example, in Gone Baby Gone, and spoilers for Gone Baby Gone, not specific spoilers, but
the baby is gone.
The baby is gone, but then comes back. Yeah. This girl goes missing, and it turns out that she was, you know, taken to protect, you know, by the cops to protect her from her drug addicted mother. And it's like, and she's returned, and it's like, is that the right, what was the right move? Who was right in what they did? And what is the right path forward? And, I was reading this interview with Lehane where he says about Gone Baby Gone, about the protagonist in Gone Baby Gone. He says, he's done the right thing, but he was wrong. He's done the wrong thing, but he was right. Like, it's just like that really crunchy question. And so like, it's funny because even before I saw that it was Dennis Lehane who wrote this episode, my thought at the beginning of the episode, when Jeannie is like, hey, Holly, okay, so Holly's not here. Why isn't she here, Ralph? Who does she know? She doesn't even have a car. Where is she? And like making Ralph ask those questions and then making Ralph like track her down. And I was, my reaction that I like wrote in my notes is like, the true measure of a good person is not doing the right thing when you know it's right. It's maybe doing the right thing when there's a part of you that wonders if it's wrong. And so like, Ralph feels like Holly is a crackpot and incorrect, and he's really frustrated with her and all this sort of stuff. But he's immediately gonna do the work to find her, because that's who Ralph is. You know, and he's not going to be like, well, whatever, this, you know, crazy person wandered into town, said all this stuff, really upset Glory, like, screw her, I don't care. He's like, no, I will find her and I will protect her, even if I wildly disagree with her and am kind of angry with her. And that, I think, is a much more interesting journey to watch than just like a good guy doing the right thing for the right reasons, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think about the Sean Penn character in Mystic River, who is, you know, dealing with a past trauma, but also, you know, in the present tense, looking for his the killer of his daughter, and like, you know, and everything he, every kind of conviction he has points him ultimately in the wrong direction. And then the story ends up with this kind of like, oh, well, that's who did it. It wasn't this thing that you thought, like it was, you know. And so I think similarly, we have someone here who's like, you know, going to this therapist as a character might in a more Catholic story, go to a priest, and just being like, is it okay for me to like think differently and to sort of like expand past what I'm sure of, you know? And there's a religious question in there. There's a philosophical question in there. And, I think that like, watching each character sort of, some more quickly than others, obviously, come to grips with like I liked when Jeannie was like, you know, you can't keep doing this. You can't keep saying that this stuff is not, that the unexplainable or something, the irrational or something isn't a fact, because it's, you know, it's just right in front of you. So I like the kind of the dawning realization that Lehane has sort of like, well, you know, threaded into this episode.
Yeah. That idea of belief. So something that, I really love this because, yeah, like Lehane's dealing with traditional Catholic spiritual belief versus what everyone in this show is grappling with, which is a different kind of belief or expanding your mind or your own experiences. Something that I like that we keep seeing are these other characters telling Ralph their stories of like what they believe. So we've got in this episode, it's the Alex Pelly character, but we already saw the character of Yoon like do his version, just these characters talking about encounters they've had, moments they've believed, what has changed their world in this way or another. And like we're watching Ralph go through his version of that right now, right?
Correct.
This is the thing that he has to confront that will forever, we assume, change his worldview, and we're in the midst of it, you know?
Yeah, and that's, I think, as a thematic arc for a season of television or a miniseries, I think it's pretty strong, and I think so far it's well done. I keep saying it, but I think this really was the episode. Like, if we really spend a lot of episode 8 with Ralph still denying, and, you know, that would be kind of frustrating. But I think that, like, you know, he's being asked to believe some pretty crazy stuff. So, it makes sense that it would take him an episode and change to kind of come around, at least to the idea, the possibility of entertaining it, you know?
And when King in this post-episode interview was talking about El Cuco and like what he thrives on, like, as we understand, he thrives on grief, the concentric circles of grief, as you were talking about. But King says something really interesting. He says that he thrives on unbelief, right?
Mm-hmm.
He is safe only if people do not believe that anything like this could possibly ever happen. That is what has kept him safe for so long. And so, like, that the greatest thing to combat this creature is to believe in him is sort of like the opposite of Tinkerbell, I suppose. And so that's another thing. Like, if we're talking about the concrete manifestation of pain and grief, we're also talking about the concrete manifestation of like of faith, right? That is the weapon is some sort of concrete manifestation of faith is the weapon against this creature, which you know, in this modern world where we don't believe in those kinds of unexplainable events, or a lot of us don't believe in those kinds of unexplainable events, that is the perfect environment for something like El Cuco to thrive. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think I'd mentioned this before, but like, you know, the ending of the first season of True Detective, another winter, you know, crime show from HBO, right, where they look up at the stars and they say there's, you know, that's like, there's a lot of dark out there, but I think Rusty Cole says, yeah, but from what I see, the light is winning, you know? And I think that, like, we're probably, hopefully, I hope anyway, arriving at a sort of similar conclusion of like, look, like, there are, the world is full of terrible things. Here is an actual physical manifestation of that. And we can beat that, but like, you know, Jack asking in the car, like, is it just one? Are there more? Like, all this. And it's like, yeah, maybe there are. Like, maybe there is a hellmouth in Cleveland. But like, we're at least going to kind of, you know, get this one sorted, because that's what people have to do to kind of move on in life. You know, you have to kind of at least conquer something, you know. And I think that's what this show, from my, what I can tell so far, is really about.
You know, in order for them to land that, like, the light is winning message at the end of this season, Andy better live. That's all to say.
No, exactly. Andy is our, like, he's our key. He's our Dawn.
Yeah, if Andy dies, the light will go out in the universe as far as I'm concerned.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Okay, speaking of that, like, thing that Ralph is grappling with, I think one of the really powerful moments of the episode is a small one, which is when he just goes over and, like, sits in that chair that Jeannie has, like, you know, put outside because El Cuco, like, sat, a projection of El Cuco sat in it and gooped it, slimed it. Mm-hmm. And Ralph is like, it's just a chair, right? But he sits in it so gingerly, and it was a really fascinating moment for me. That chair.
Yeah. Well, yeah, became this cursed object, you know, all of a sudden. And it's covered in goo, so I don't blame him, Jeannie.
I would not have sat in the goo chair personally, yeah. But you know. And
I was in college once. I sat in plenty of goo chairs. Those days are behind me.
It's true. You mentioned True Detective. This episode reminded me a lot of True Detective, and I wasn't like fully sure why. And then Dennis Lehane said, like, in his little Talking Head interview, he's like, "Oh, I love characters talking in cars." And I was like, oh, that's all that season one of True Detective was, which ruled my favorite season of True Detective. Yeah.
Your favorite wasn't season two?
if only Tim Riggins had a car instead of a motorcycle, maybe two would have been my favorite. But, like, you've got Holly and Jack, and they've got several car conversations that we cut to. And then you also have Alex and Ralph. And it is this... You know, the tension of putting Holly in that car, and as I said earlier, the question being not so much like, is this guy going to kill her, which is a question, but also like just the struggle that Jack is going through because he doesn't know what he's going to do and he doesn't know how much he can control is really powerful. And then like his vulnerability and all of that. I really like the part where he was like, she's like, why didn't you kill me before I gave my presentation? Like, if that's what El Cuco wanted, you know, El Cuco said, stop me, why did you let me go? And he was like, I just thought you'd have more information than you had. Like, I thought you'd have the answer to what I should do. So, yeah. I did want to talk about Glory. You mentioned sort of like Glory's arc in this episode, but I think that this sort of speaks to a question that, a listener wrote in about why is the Maitland family sort of still alive and somewhat thriving when the other families were exploded? And I think the answer is we're still in the middle of the cycle, right?
Right.
Because, like, Glory here, what happens to Glory when she tries to go back to work? And then even more so, I feel like, Glory talking to Howie about all the people they're going to sue. And like, you know, Howie brings up the question, are you going to go after individuals? So like, AKA Ralph, like, are you going to sue Ralph? What is that going to do to your relationship to Jeannie? Is the grief, you know, and Howie almost seemed to be like stoking that, you know, in a way that all just felt like El Cuco would had like a tasty meal out of that phone call. You know what I mean? Cause it's just like the grief and the pain and the damage widening, after what Glory went through in this episode.
And it's making her a pessimist, you know? We don't know for certain that the young couple was actually thinking any of those things, you know?
Right.
When she was, maybe, you know, the woman said that's not fair, so clearly they maybe knew who she was, but that doesn't mean that they were thinking in such negative terms, you know? And so, you know, like, that is a kind of, you know, a death in a way of one's idealism and one's sort of previous self, you know? So yeah, I think Glory, unfortunately, the character is still very much in a precarious position, you know?
Right. She's in crisis. Her daughters are in crisis. And then like, if she goes after her, cause I feel like every time she talks to Jeannie and Ralph, it's like, we're moving towards a place of healing. And then every time there's something that drives a further wedge between them, you know, it's they're on a path of damage for all parties concerned, you know, so.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you a little bit about like the political aspects of this episode. One is when Holly and Jack are in the car and he turns on the radio, and it's like, you know, a political chat show or whatever. And this guy is saying like, he says, they laugh in New York and they laugh in San Francisco, but they will not be laughing when the mouth of hell opens up. And then he changes the station to a Ricky Nelson song. But, you know, the setting, I don't know, like maybe I'm just reading too much into it, but that feels like a super intentional thing. And it's like, okay, so tell me if you think I'm reading too much into it. But like the idea of our political, our current political discourse and the way in which like certain parties stoke division and fear and pain and grief, you know, like this is like, I don't think Fox News ever says when the mouth of hell opens up, but you know, like
they might as well though. I mean,
right. Like that sort of like pushing people to their pain and grief points, which is like what El Cuco does. And I feel like this inclusion of this snippet of radio is supposed to be like, and we have that in our own society in other avenues. Do you think that that's a reach or what do you think, Richard?
No, I think that's a fair read of it. Certainly. I think maybe there's also a little bit of saying, well, you know, look, like there are people who believe in supernatural things and, you know, wicked forces and all that. Like, but in some ways they don't have it right either, you know? I think it's offering a little ambivalence in a way. I think also like, you know, it does ground it in a place, you know, we are talking about rural Georgia here, you know?
Right.
I think it gives it that context and, you know, the show doesn't really talk about this much, but like here we have kind of a violent good old boy white cop in a car alone with a black woman in rural Georgia. Like there is an inherent tension there. And if for Holly's sake, like a certain, you know, beyond the obvious danger. And I think that like, you know, that little snippet that we hear of the radio is just reminding you that like, yeah, there's like there is a kind of anger and malevolence in the world anyway, without this entity stalking everybody.
And what makes it so much more interesting is that, like, that's not really who Jack is, right? Like, his closest woman is, like, friend is this, like, female Asian cop, right? And, like, in the post-episode interview, they were like, Jack really likes Holly. So it's not like he's not a sexist racist, but he exists in that archetypical, like, sphere,
right,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
And I think that tension is what makes this show so much more interesting. Because, like, if he were just, like, a racist misogynist, like, the moment when Holly is talking to him and she's like, you look like you're going through some kind of hell in last week's episode, right? Like, someone's eating your heart out or whatever she says. And he says that thing about his wife leaving him and how it was the best day of his life. But, like, it seems so obviously not the case, right? He not only has this trauma of whatever his mother did to him as a kid, but, like, this more recent trauma of, like, his marriage dissolving. And, you know, we know that he just like hangs around the strip club and is angry all the time and stuff like that. But like, there's what's underneath all of that is a pain. And that's what she's saying, like, El Cuco is drawn to, which is like your hurt that you're nursing around this.
Right.
That's a compelling concept.
And, you know? And I think, you know, going back to the sort of religious allusions with the therapist, like, not that they were explicitly said, but I think, again, it felt like a scene where someone goes to confession.
Yeah.
Like, the show is showing, like, illustrating, like, an outlet for that, you know, not that going to therapy, like, you know, removes pain from your life, but it helps you process it and it helps lift the burden some, you know, and in doing, then you would give off less for something to feed off of, you know what I mean? So I think it's offering a sort of an alternative to the, you know, the sort of internal struggle that Jack has kind of found himself mired in and maybe made him a good target for, this demon. You know, I did though that like the joke about the how many psychologists does it take to screw in a light bulb? One, but the light
joke.
Bulb really has to want to change. Like, it's a great joke. I'm going to use that joke.
Holly should have laughed. That was a good joke, yeah. Jack. Yeah. So you find yourself like, liking or sympathizing with Jack in a way that you didn't expect. Anyway,
well, you pity him, you know.
Yeah.
And you hope, like Holly does, that he can be come out of this thing okay, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that will be, I mean, I don't see a way out of this for Jack, unfortunately, but I think, you know, something that will feel emotionally satisfying is if he sacrifices himself in some way to protect Holly and Ralph. You know, if he is able to stand up against, and Andy, of course, obviously, if he's able to stand up against this demon that has taken over him. You talking about the therapist in terms of Catholic confession, which I think is brilliant, makes me think of, like, reconsider what we see of Jack when he's in these, you know, it reminds me of, and like, forgive me because I'm an atheist, so I don't know a lot about, you know, religious practices, but like in, I know from films that in some forms of extreme zealotry, there's like that, the moment of self-flagellation, you know what I mean? Like when you're in confession or whatever, and you've sinned, you physically abuse your own flesh as I think it's atonement, would be my guess.
Penitence, yeah,
penitence. And Holly says to Jack, you know, like he does this thing where he did not, kill her, stop her the way that El Cuco wanted to him to in the last episode. And Holly says, and look how he's made you pay. You know what I mean? Like, look at like how he's made you atone for defying him, the devil, or whatever you want to call it, the Joker, as Jack calls him at one point. So yeah, one thing I will say about Jack, if you were to try idly to crack someone's iPhone code, would you try 111111? Because that's what Jack tried on Holly's phone.
No, I would have done 00001, then 00002, and then the phone would have been bricked and it would have been useless.
Yeah. So the other sort of sociopolitical thing that I want to introduce is this idea of who gets to be believed. So what I think was powerful was you have Jeannie and Holly talking to Ralph and being like, you can't keep denying this. And I think it was powerful. I mean, like, Andy is an ally, and Andy was standing next to Ralph in that scene. He's an ally of Holly's, but like, it seemed powerful to me, especially the way in which they were raising their voices, which seemed uncharacteristic for both of these women, of like a, you know, why won't you believe us, these two women in your life, sort of thing. Do you feel like that they're, am I reading too much into this? Is there something gendered in that dynamic?
No, I think totally that, I think that's totally there, you know. Yeah. That, you know, this is, I think, you know, I think Ralph too, because in another, you know, I guess less thoughtful version of this story, like, Ralph is your prototypical kind of hard charging, you know, cop with an attitude who then, you know, has a kind of latent third act epiphany, you know, and then like learns the errors to some extent of his ways, but we still kind of appreciate that toughness and that brashness. He's never really been that except for the thing, the mistake he makes in having Terry publicly arrested, which he then apologizes and atones for like shortly after, you know?
Right.
So I think that what the show is saying is that even someone who is, you know, can talk about his emotion, who can, you know, to some extent he can, you know, is a compassionate person. Even that man can be stubborn and not listen to women and, you know, like kind of believe that the way that he sees the world is the default setting of the world. And, you know, and a part of his arc is kind of unpacking that and sort of moving past it, hopefully.
Yeah, I really see, you know, you and I have been like, okay, this is a 10 episode season. How long can this character believably not believe, you know?
Right.
And so I think this move to have Jeannie and Holly yell at him, I was thinking of you in that moment. I was like, this will hopefully please Richard. Because, like, you know, if you need to have a character, you know, do something that's frustrating to the audience, if you call it out in the episode, then that can sort of soothe us a little bit. So we're like, okay, we're not the only ones yelling at him to be like, you dummy, believe. Like, there's these other characters are yelling that too. So at least, you know, we're not alone in our frustration.
Yeah. And I was thinking about it and I was like, okay, so what will like the ultimate acceptance of this, you know, horrifying reality be for Ralph? And yes, I'm sure there will be an actual like confrontation with this entity in Claude form, perhaps.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why Patty Constantine's there, because we're going to see him play the bad thing, maybe. But like, okay, so then you kind of have to accept it if it's right in front of you. But I think the more interesting dynamic, if the show goes this way, and who knows, is when Ralph, as a sort of representative of the police force, has to sort of disclose to the public in order to help Gloria and her family that like Terry Maitland did not do that, did not kill this kid, you know, and how he's going to frame that and what he's going to say. And, you know, I don't know if that moment's going to happen, but I was just thinking about that as that being like a kind of crucial point of acceptance for him, you know, to sort of somehow inform the public that like he got it very wrong, you know?
Yeah. One thing I know for certain, no matter what it is, Ben Mendelsohn is going to play it like perfectly. Mm-hmm. There are moments like, there are just choices he makes. Like when Alex Pelley is in the car and telling him about his like, which I think, I mean, so the episode title is In the Pines, which is, you know, a lyric, or title from a traditional folk song, In the Pines, where the sun never shines, shiver when the cold wind blows. That I think is a reference to what Alex experienced in the forest. Cause like, I think that's what a lot of these titles are about these sort of like folk tales or weird occurrences, right? Like the Yiddish vampire and the like, mm-hmm. you know, the tear drinker and like whatever, like that's what these episode titles are. And Ben Mendelsohn did this thing with his face where he just sort of like locked it down in this sort of like resentful, like stubborn, I will not take this in sort of position, which I just thought was, you know, really like, it's just, I could watch his face all day is my point. I have two more things before we hop off, unless you have anything else, which is, number one, I thought the, like, Alex and Ralph figuring out what happened to Holly and Jack, it sort of, like, stretches belief, my belief that they would do that all in, like, what they said they were 90 minutes behind them, like, that they figured all of that out in 90 minutes, is, you know, that they figured out Jack was somehow, like, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it felt a little rushed.
It felt rushed.
And convenient.
But also, like, these are guys who are very good at what they do, and they did at least have Jack's apartment to go off of, which is, like, if I saw that, I'd be like, get that guy. Mm-hmm. I don't care if he's taking Holly to Froyo. He also needs to go to therapy, so, like, mm-hmm. let's find this guy, you know? So, yeah, so that aspect. And then, I apologize at the top of this episode, I got the director's name wrong. It's Dana Reed. And, there's plenty of things that, like, a director, like, it's hard to know who to credit when you're watching a TV show for what, in terms of, like, was this scripted or did the director make this choice? But one shot that we see multiple times that feels like a director's choice, though I could be wrong, is this image of, like, a bug on its back, sort of, like, maybe mm-hmm. dying or whatever. What did you make of that repeated image?
Oh, I thought it was a reference to the famous Nine Inch Nails video with all the bugs. I think that, you know, like the image of this kind of thing that a lot of people find creepy, icky, like a bug, like which, like I do or whatever, but like on its back and flailing helplessly, you know, like there are a lot of people in the show who that could maybe be visually representative of, like I think Jack most of all, but right
Jack,
now, but
yeah.
like, but yeah, no, I think that, you know, it's, this show does not do a ton of kind of artsy flourishes like that.
Yeah.
And so when they're in there, you're kind of like, okay, this is very purposeful, you know?
Right. What does this mean? The other thing that I noticed in this episode, not for the first time, but like really noticed, is the art design, the like production design on, Ralph and Jeannie's house. There's just something about it that is so specifically like slightly older couple, Like, there's nothing, like, cool or stylish about their house at all.
Right.
And it's not, like, ugly or anything like that. It's just sort of, like, the art is all, like, consistently one very, like, strong look. Do you know what I mean? That it's just, like, it's kind of square and, like, a little old. And, like, I love that for them. I love, you know, I love that Jeannie's sewing room is also where the printer is. There's just, you know, it's just, like, it all feels so completely real of, you know, even though it's not a place I've ever been to. You know?
Yeah. One other thing about production design in this episode that I have to a nit to pick is when Gloria's giving the home tour and they go into the kitchen and there's a pot filler over the stove. Uh-huh. I don't buy for a second that house with that dated kitchen, not too dated, but dated enough with that kind of stove. I think production glued that fake pot filler onto that wall just to satisfy that line. I didn't buy the pot filler in that kitchen for a second.
Because that's a modern convenience, the pot filler.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know when it goes back to, but like I watch a lot of home design, you know, HGTV and stuff like that, and it's like it's just kind of becoming a standard thing now.
What if the last people who lived there really loved pasta?
I mean,
and they had it installed. Yeah,
maybe, but then she calls it a dump, the house, you know, and like it's like, but it has the pot filler. So,
that house is nice. Gloria was just fun. In her feelings in the moment. Yeah. I loved her description of it too. She's just like, you know, pasta water. I was like, okay, Glory. I know you're going through some stuff, but you're not bringing your realtor A game here. It's okay. Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about the pot filler. I'm glad you brought it up. Okay. Well, I think we did it. I don't know what we're going to see next week. Hopefully, what I would like them to start doing more of is, so Claude has quit his job. He has left town. I know where he goes in the book. I don't know if that's going to be where he goes in the show. I'm not going to say. Wherever he's going, I would like to get much more of Claude next week as we're ramping up to the finale so that the stakes of like caring about him, because I default care about him because I care about that actor, but like so that we like care about him. So that the sight of him being an evil person is more disturbing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, I feel like we will get more of him. Like, and because I love the detail that I kind of was like, oh, right, of course. When they were like, why didn't you tell me that this drawing looks kind of like Claude? You know, so like, so the creature is almost maybe complete in its, mimicking of him, cycle.
Yeah.
So like, that's interesting. I also loved, you know, again, this show kind of infusing things with little moments of humanity. That scene that was in some ways totally unnecessary between him and the guy who owned the script club being like, here's a little extra, you know, blah, 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 you know, like, good luck or whatever. Like, I just thought it was like, yes, because these are people and, you know, are for the most part decent. So, I think Patty Considine's big episode big episodes will be the next couple.
Yeah. I just need more of like real Claude before we get evil Claude. It's like similar to like, you don't need to do that work with Jason Bateman necessarily because that's a character, that's an actor we're even more familiar with. So like seeing him covered in blood, is in and of itself a like disturbing image. But I feel like audiences who are not so familiar with the great works of Patty Considine, including In America and other films, need a little bit more time with him. So that would be my hope for the next. That's the work I think they need to do. That and protecting Andy are the two things that the show needs to do. All right. Richard, until next time, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm just going to be lugging. I have to fill up all these pots with water and the sink and then carry them all the way over to the stove. It's going to take me all week. So that's where I'm going to be. And if I have time between this arduous task, I will be tweeting from Rylaz and writing for VF.com. Joanna, where will you be until the 8th episode recap?
I will be changing my phone password to 1111111 because I think no one will ever try to guess that.
Right.
And when I'm done with that, I will be at vf.com or on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And we will see you all for episode 8 next week.
Check your necks.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.